Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, then it's just because...
I'll be back.
Yeah, okay.
There aren't enough parts.
But still, I mean, it's still the same idea there, because in that compton scattering just means there's a photon and an electron coming in.
So, yeah, so we need these two coming in, and those two going out. You can't connect those to a single vertex.
Right.
Sort of a stupid question. I would probably just answer this other problem. Where conservation of momentum is here. You can't have that because, say, you go to the center of mass strength. Okay, so your initial total core momentum is going to be E and G plus E and minus A, which is in the center of mass strength. So that's the total momentum in the center of mass frame. Here, the final momentum gain, it's just the momentum of that photon. And here, KU is h bar squared omega squared minus h bar squared k squared zero. But here, P mu is 4 e squared. Not incredible. So you can't conserve momentum. Just get that. We'll say that again in a minute. Here we go. So the Compton scattering is just, there are too many parts. You can't connect them up with one vertex. You've got two coming in, two going out. So there's no way I can have all four of those coming to a single vertex. I was probably thinking of this, where you can't have electron positron annihilation into a single photon because you can't conserve momentum. Right? The total incoming momentum in the center of mass frame is 2e and 0. And that's never a null vector. The four momentum of a photon is h bar omega and k, where k squared equals omega squared. So the final momentum has magnitude 0. The initial momentum has squared magnitude, definitely not 0. And so you can't conserve momentum.
Okay.
For that. Now we did this, nonetheless, by a little bit of sleight of hand. When we did the Coulomb scattering, right, the Coulomb scattering, you have a particle that interacts with a photon and you just mask the effect of some, really, you're neglecting the effect of some heavy nucleus or something there. And you can get away with that if you're careful for that problem. And that's enough to get you the Coulomb interactions we saw. When did I say your midterm is due? The Compton scattering problem.
I'm just trying to scare you.
It worked. There's a stony silence. But it's due sometime. So do it.
Okay.
While we're thinking about QED, okay, I've got maybe Jeremy can check for it, but I'm pretty sure I've got that on the Pavlov scattering.
Oh right.
Let's see.
And I've I put a correction into the other scattering cross section I had to do. It was a minor thing. I forget what it was, but I fixed it.
Maybe I need to reload the same page.
That
should do. There it is.
Okay, good. And it worked with one modification from what we did in class. We've calculated all the squared matrix elements. And the differential cross-section is just putting that with some factors of like 16 pi squared. Okay, I'm not sure I've got that written down here. And then doing the kinematics in the center of mass frame. There's one more thing I need to mention that we overlooked. When we write these matrix elements, let's just write one for something. Say we've got, we're looking at electron positron, and they exchange a photon. So let's look at this case. So the matrix element for this was, what do we have? We bring the let's call this U of T. This would be U bar of T prime. This would be D coming in this way of what we call it. This will be K prime. Here we'll have D bar of K minus I E gamma mu minus I E gamma mu. And here we'll have a minus I A of U mu over 2 squared, where 2 is the difference between the momentum. Let me just get one of these things down. Gamma mu, U bar, U of, let's see, that's U bar of P prime with U of P. And then we have minus I, A of U mu over 2 squared. And then D bar of K minus I E gamma mu and D of K prime. Okay, so we get the matrix element and we rewrite it with some indices. Minus, that's going to be I A of U nu over Q squared. So that all comes out. Then we have a gamma mu A B U B P B B bar K gamma nu B D B D. Times the complex conjugate. Okay, I don't need to do the whole thing to show you what's going on here. Yes, I do. I need these other terms. So, when we square this thing, so this was K prime, then we have a B bar of K prime T gamma alpha B of K EF. And then the U, U bar G of P beta U, see that's GH, UH, P prime. Okay, there we go. Got it. And then there's an eta alpha beta over U squared, there's an E squared, all that stuff again. There's a minus R. Okay, so that's the squared matrix element for that interaction, for that graph. Okay, so here's the point. The next step is to move, say, this spinner over here so we can do the sum on spin. That's going to give us, UH of G prime U bar A of D prime. We want the someone to sit in here. We'll take a quarter. So we have someone spin for this thing. Okay. And that's going to be E slash prime plus. That's all fine, except we forgot one thing we did to have. The spinner field. Spinner field's anti-commute. So when I move this spinner field past that spinner field, I get a minus sign. And, okay, I've passed 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 spinner fields. So I get an overall minus sign when I move that way. So the thing you have to do is just count up how many things pass one another. And there are like 14 or 15. And, you know, it's trivial to count. You know, you just count as you do it, and you'll see how many spinner fields have passed one another. And you have minus 1 to that power. So if you've done 14 interchanges, okay, minus 1 is 14, it's plus 1, no big deal. But if it's 15, that's a minus 1. And that happens in the Babak scattering problem for the cross terms. The cross terms have an odd number of interchanges. And so they come in with a relative minus sign compared to the two squared terms, which come in with, I think it was 14. And you'll find this in the notes online. I put in those factors with my count of how many factors there were. That was the only thing about all that we did that didn't work out right. There was a funny sign somewhere, and that's where it was. The next thing to do, okay, we've calculated all these squared matrix elements. We have a simple formula for the differential cross section. It's a two particle final state when from our text. Let me see. Cross section, two body final state. So 1 over 64 pi squared f. That's elastic scattering. Are we doing elastic scattering? No, there's nowhere else for the energy to go. So d sigma, d omega, 1 over, wasn't that 64? 16? 64 pi squared. And squared matrix element. And we've already computed that, so that doesn't add a whole lot. This is the expression you get after all of the integration of the conservation momentum delta function is done. You have a two-body final state. You have two particles coming out here. And so there's a d3t for each one. D3t prime is a d3k prime over some factors. And they're multiplied by a four-dimensional Dirac delta function. So we do all six integrals, and we end up with this. Where this d omega is solid angle, that depends on phi and theta. So that's the remaining two integrals. This can be undone, typically, to give the differential cross-section. So the probability for scattering through a solid angle d omega. And we put everything into this. And recall, this thing depends on products of dot products of four momentum. So now we have to do a big substitution. I don't have that formula with me. I didn't get a chance to print this out before I left, but I can see the PDF is on those computers. In the center of mass frame, we can compute the various four momenta. So we start with say, the incoming electron, and we assign it an energy E and a three momentum T. Then, since we're in the center of mass frame, the incoming positron has got to have the same energy and minus the same three momentum. So, no new variables introduced there. We also know that E squared is equal to T squared plus M squared, and since we're doing the ultra-relativistic case, that's E squared. So, actually, T is just some unit vector times E again. Right? We only have, right, that unit vector is going to give us the cosine theta in the final differential cross-section. So, those are the only two variables we're going to end up left with, right? Some angle theta between two final, typically the final electron three momentum and the initial electron three momentum, or as good as any, the angle between those can be theta. So let's introduce P prime, and we're in the center of mass frame. We still have to have a total energy E. So we're going to have the same energy here as we have in that initial state, except now we've got a three-vector P prime, and then K prime has to be the same thing, except with minus three-vector P prime as the spatial part. So, fairly simple expression. And then it's straightforward to work out all the dot products, where we take T dot T prime equal to the magnitude of T, magnitude of T prime, times the cosine of theta. And that defines the cosine of theta. Well, this is just E squared cosine theta in the ultra-relativistic approximation where the mass is zero. By the way, I should mention that it's not that much harder to do the mass terms. Right? We dropped all the mass terms, and that saves us writing about half the terms. But remember when we were finding those traces, we'd get a p squared and we'd say, ah, throw it away, it's zero. Well, if you keep the mass terms, that's m squared, and it comes out, and you've eliminated two gamma. So you still have reduced the order of the trays anytime you get, you know, a P slash or a K slash, it comes out as an M squared instead of coming out as zero. Well, so you have to keep the term, but you have reduced the order of the trays. And it's just a little bit more bookkeeping. The final matrix element ends up with twice the number of terms, but it's not all that horrific. Okay, so everything is now expressed in terms of a single angle and the incoming energy of either one of the particles. So the next thing to do is make yourself a table of the dot products. You have this. So just go through and work out each of the dot products of each pair of momenta. Well, there are half a dozen of those. So T dot T prime, for example, is what? Well, we're going to have E squared minus T dot T prime three vector, and that's E squared times minus, since the magnitudes of these are each E as well, you just get a 1 minus cos theta factor here. And just work your way through, you've got K, so everything is going to have an overall magnitude of E squared, and then P dot K, you're going to have an E squared, but because of the relative minus sign, it becomes plus in the Lorentz product. So we have 1 plus cosine theta Everybody see how that works? Let me put in another line here. We have E squared minus P dot minus P, right, which is E squared plus 3 vector P squared. Oh.
P.
Oh,
okay.
Sorry. This one's not that. What is this one? That's just E squared. So we get 2 E squared. Sorry. That should be right. Let's see. Define. Yeah. Right. I was thinking of P dot K prime. But this is just E squared, right? Did I do this right?
Yeah.
Do it for a second. Okay. So what's next? P dot K prime. This is what I thought I was doing. So like K prime. So, once again, I get an E squared. I get a plus when I subtract P dotted with minus P prime. But that gives me cosine theta. So I'm going to get an E squared, and it'll be 1 plus cos theta. There, that's the one I was thinking of. Now we take K dot A dot K dot P prime. K dot P prime, the two middle two, there's a relative minus sign, we get the cos theta. So it's E squared 1 plus cos theta. K dot K prime is K dot K prime is a minus E squared 1 minus cos theta. And finally, P prime dot K prime. And all six of these occur. So the last two, it becomes a 2 E squared again. They're added.
Is P and P prime the same magnitude? I'm just curious.
Okay. Yeah, they have to be.
Okay.
Right. Because we also have... the magnitude here, E squared, is P prime squared plus M squared. Same math here, so even in that case, it would be the same. But we're going to drop that. So, yeah, the conservation of energy here is, in the absence of the math, is very restricted. So, yeah, everything's the same. It's just that one angle. We also need S squared. That's the total incoming momentum. So P plus K quantity squared, that's just the 2E time component with 4E squared. And finally, T squared, that's, what is it? Hang on, get the right diagram up here so we can see. We're looking at a T channel process. So we have T coming in, T prime going out, and Q going this way. So P minus P prime is Q. So Q squared is T, and that's equal to T squared plus P prime squared minus twice P dot P prime. But P squared and P prime squared, those are each M squared, and we're dropping that. So we're going to get a couple factors of M squared that we throw out, and then we have minus 2 times P dot P prime is this first one, E squared 1 minus cos theta. Notice anything funny about that? All the others are positive. That's S and T, not S and T squared. S is the square of Q, T is the square of Q to the respective. T is negative. Why is P negative? What does it mean for P to be negative? Think space-time diagram.
Time-like or space-like.
The space-like. Yeah, that photon is space-like.
Oh, right.
It's a virtual photon. It can be anything it wants, right? So space-like is fine. But, yeah, that photon, you know, it's, okay, it looks kind of space-like there. Well, it is. So, P comes out next. Okay, and then we substitute these, like the knife for this, in the, substitute into each of the dot products in this formula. And m squared ends up having, I just built out a product of, you know, like p dot k and p prime dot k prime, you know, sums and differences of things like that. There are about, I don't know, 8 terms or so. Not so many.
Sorry. If that photon is space-like, is it going faster than the speed of light then, or would we say, or... it's crazy.
Yeah, personally not very far.
I know, but...
That's an axionic photon.
Okay.
fortunately, you don't measure it. It's a piece of the calculation.
Okay.
Right. Overall conservation of momentum. No, nothing has measurably been conveyed any distance faster than the speed of light. But yeah, you've got to integrate over, you know, all possible things. Things are not constrained. It's like a math integral. You know, the particle follows every possible path. Not one of all possible paths. Every possible path. You know, it interferes with itself as it does, right? We've got the cross terms in this, right? This diagram knows about the other diagram. They interfere and contribute to the cross section. So, you don't worry too much about this. Oh, yeah, that's a virtual photon. It can do anything it wants, right? In fact, everything is happening here, and it's happening all at once. And it all knows about all the other stuff. And the final result is this complicated interference of all of these diagrams that give us a false feeling of security, like we know what's happening. Oh, that photon is in the here, and it lands there. Now we integrate over all positions where that could happen. Yeah. And let it interfere with the other diagram. There's no one thing happening in quantum physics. There's a lot more going on than we're used to thinking about. This is one of the big advantages of Feynman diagrams, is that it lets us think in terms of sort of classical processes. Simple scattering, you know, particle emitted here, absorbed there. It's not what happened. It's a picture that reminds us of a piece of a calculation. But it gives us some power for thinking about and keeping track of that calculation, because it appeals to our intuitions about what's going on. But it's all going on. Okay, then we get an answer. Substituting, okay, you've got, you know, maybe 8 terms, each of which is a product of 2 of these. So, you know, you've got a little bit of algebra to do. It's not really bad. So you finally get an answer. I'll write it up here and let you study it online. Alpha squared over, what do we get? 8 e squared. Okay, notice. I'm writing this in terms of sines and cosines of the half angle. That's because all of these 1 plus cos and 1 minus cosine terms can be written as, you know, sine squared theta over 2 or cosine squared theta over 2. Maybe times a factor of 2 or something. So it simplifies it a bit. And it also helps you spot the similarity to something like Rutherford scattering over 2. Then half is a 1 plus cosine squared theta term. And finally, minus 2 cosine 4 theta over 2 over sine squared theta over 2. And let's see, the non-relativistic, this is ultra-relativistic. Yeah, the full formula, oh, I'm not going to write that here. I'll just waft it under your noses here. Here's the full formula up top. You know, this is the one we just derived. This is the one that if you leave the mass in, right, this bit there. So, you know, it's messier, but it's not, you know, beyond human comprehension. So just this top thing is the full solution with the mass in.
What's that last term?
This is the full answer. This is the one we just got. This bottom one down here is the non-relativistic.
All right.
Okay.
The whole two lines there. Yeah, that whole thing is the it's including the masses.
So you know, I won't take the time to write that all up, but. Then the non-relativistic, let me put that up for a second. Is just alpha squared over m. Probably the velocity.
Is alpha like the Planck structure
constant? Yeah, alpha is the Planck structure constant. So alpha is, I think it's 4 pi squared e squared in the units we're using. The other way, over 4 pi squared. That's where the 64 pi squared ends up going into Planck structure constant. V is the relative velocity. And it's not hard to get like a first order correction to this non-relativistic case. Notice you have the Rutherford sine 4 of theta over 2. Right? The Rutherford cross section has that factor. It also has, you can write this, m squared v to the fourth, you can write this as 64 times the energy squared. So that mass and that can be written as 64 times a half mv squared. So you see that the energy squared crops up. You still have that. You have that factor in both cases. The energy. I suppose twice that is what you expect if you've got the two parts. So the total energy you've got a factor. In the ultra-relativistic case, that doesn't look a whole lot like sine to the fourth theta over 2. Right, so you know Rutherford didn't get it entirely right here. That's very different from Rutherford scattering. He wasn't doing it relativistically. Now, if you look at I wonder if there's some limit in which you could see it. Now, even I'm thinking maybe small theta. All right, at small angles, it's going to be dominated by the first term, and the numerator would be about 2. So, you know, you could see the Rutherford limit of this at narrow angles. It's at larger angles where these things contribute this most strongly. If you do a slightly relativistic case of the scattering, you find a 1 plus cos squared theta term that has a big effect at large angles. It really suppresses the large angle. Is it 1 plus cos theta maybe? It's something that really only has an effect at large angles. Edson and Zuber have a nice diagram here. They take the time to redo the calculation for the case of scalar fields. So, if you had scalar electrodynamics, a scalar particle that could emit a photon or absorb a photon, and you look at the same process in that case, have you got this?
I have it on the strikeboard.
Let me just sketch the picture here. They present some data and put the two models side by side. So, for example, for this case, there are two theoretical curves that look like this. This is scalar Baba scattering and spinner Baba scattering. And the data are, you know, you've got, this is back in the 70s, you get 3 data points and they look like this. So this is a direct experimental demonstration that spinner model for the electron is crucial. You can't treat the electron as a scalar field and get it right. So there's a substantial difference there. He doesn't overlay these diagrams, but he also plots and calculates the cross-section for electron-electron scattering. And electron-electron scattering in these kind of limits, it's very different. It's very different. Now, if you look at Rutherford scattering, it doesn't matter whether the two charges are oppositely or identically charged. It swings around this way if it goes that way. If it's attracted and is repelled, it goes on this side. But that's all in the incoming flux. That doesn't affect the overall probability for scattering as 1 over sine 4 theta over 2. But in general, electrons and positrons scatter very differently. E plus E minus is very different from electron-electron. And in the detail, you see a lot of difference in these in the theta dependence. It's not just the factor of 2 either. We talked about before, if we have electron-electron, we have 2 diagrams where the electrons do this, or the electrons come in but cross, so they do that. But you do not have the annihilation diagram. And Q here is C minus T prime. Q here is C minus K prime. Whereas for the electron-positron case, E plus E minus, you have an annihilation diagram like this, E plus E minus, and Q here is T plus E prime. Now, at low enough energy, T plus T prime squared is a lot bigger than T minus T prime, where those momenta are canceling one another out, and that means that since the propagator goes like 1 over q squared, these two contribute a lot more. They've got a smaller denominator than the thing where you're adding the incoming momentum. And, you know, that suggests that you might get something on the order of a factor of two. And you can see there's an overall factor of something on the, in the neighborhood of two. But really, the interference between this diagram and that diagram is much different than the interference between those two. You get really different angular dependence. So that's also experimentally determined and checked. And field theory works.
I have a quick question.
Yeah.
If you had a high order diagram with more than one terminal, would you have like terms when you square each individual diagram? Like some of the terms, for example? Or
does the first order diagrams interact with the second?
Well,
Well,
one second order diagram, you square that, right? Would you have like a sum of terms? Would it, If you had just like one second order diagram, or third order, for example, more than one internal propagator, would you get like a sum of terms when you square just that one diagram?
Yes. All right. So.
Okay. Or am I making sense?
The matrix element is a sum of all the terms.
Right.
Right. So you need to sum the terms and then square. So you will get interference
between
lower and higher order terms.
Right, right. Right, but I'm saying, you know.
Okay, so you're asking something different. I'm not getting it.
In the square, though, you know, it's like, yeah, okay. When you square, it's like you get each of these squares along with all the.
You'll get these same things. But then there will be other
higher order stuff, right? Because of the cross terms, okay.
Right.
But what I'm saying, like, how would you, or, let's see, if we were to put some other loop in one of these, right, okay?
Yeah.
What would the matrix element look like? That's my question. All right.
Ah.
Yeah.
The matrix element, okay. So, yeah, we haven't talked a whole lot about it. Have you got all this?
Yeah.
Let's see, we could try and write Ron's one down. The problem that you run into is that you're introducing something that will meet renormalization.
Okay.
So when you put in loops, you have to integrate. Yes, there will be an undetermined momentum going around the loop that you have to integrate. So if we have, let's do our E plus E minus, and then we can put an E plus E minus loop in the middle of it, and get our E plus and E minus out. So at fourth order, we could have this, it's cubic order, not sure you can get it into absorbent, so we need to add two probably. But now when we do this diagram, what do we have? You know, there's some momentum here. Okay, if we start with P and K down there, then which we're going to run out of letters. Let's call this Q1 is equal to P plus K. Those two just add to produce that photon. And then this split into, let's call it Q2, and on this side, we're going to have Q1 minus Q2 for the momentum going around the other side. And we're going to have to integrate over Q2. It won't be determined by conservation of momentum. We're conserving momentum all the way here. Then we have another Q1 here, and then finally P prime, and I guess I've reversed this from what we did before, but in fact, let's not reverse it from what we did before. Okay, so what would the matrix element look like? Let's write it. Okay. I. Now, what happens is, you know, there's a divergent piece in here, and the divergent pieces are assigned names, and they get taken up by the renormalization. There are three in QED. There are three different specific forms of divergence that have to be renormalized out, and that takes care of, that'll take care of every divergence you ever run across in QED. So the divergent part of this integral is managed by absorbing it into the mass. I forget which one this is. But we should be able to write the matrix element anyway. And then at the point where we have to do this divergent integral over the propagators in here, then we will write it in a way that isolates the divergent part as, oh, we call that B3, and that's going to be absorbed into the mass. And then everything else contributes. So you get contributions, finite contributions from this that way. But so we start off the same way. We've got this is going to be a B bar of K. This is going to be a U of T. Let's see, we're going to need to assign some fields here. Let's see, what will those be? Something like a... let's just call it a U2 of Q2, and... this trick again. Then this is going to be... So you can imagine things around this way. B2 of Q1 minus Q2. And let's see, that'll be this will be barred up here, it'll be unbarred down here. Yeah, so we'll have a U2 bar down here and a B2 down here. Up here we'll have a B2 bar and a U2. You know, remember we think of the V is coming from future to past, and the U is going to a U bar up here. So, same thing here. You know, here's the past, there's the future, so we've got a B going to a we've got a, which one did I say it? We should have a B going to a B bar here, we should have a U going to a U bar there. Maybe. Which way is that? Probably back to back. Okay, if we make this vertex look like that vertex, make this vertex look like this vertex. Yeah. So, this vertex, you've got a B bar and a U producing a photon. This vertex, you've got a U and a B bar producing a photon. So, there's a way to make it through. So, we just go, we rank these things, right?
Why is each segment labeled twice? Oh, it's the vertex.
It's the vertex. So you're looking at what's coming into or going out of each vertex.
Okay.
So we're going to have four vertices in this thing. So the first one, we've got B bar of K and minus I E gamma mu U of B. Okay. And then we have a propagator for Q1. Minus I eta mu nu over U1 squared. Then we reach this vertex, which looks like that vertex. So we expect the electron U bar to come first. So that's U2 bar, and we call that Q2. And then gamma nu. And then we've got a V2. And that's Q1 minus Q2. Like that. Okay, and then we have we need propagators for the electron and the positron field. So we're going to have a Q2 slash plus M over Q2 squared minus M squared. Remember, that's the propagator for a spinner. We also have a propagator for the other one. So it's Q1 minus Q2 slash plus M. Like antiparticle, so M would be a minus M over Q1 plus Q2 squared plus M squared. And then, okay, so we have our two propagators, then we have another vertex. And this one has a V bar, Q1 minus Q2. Then gamma alpha U of Q2. And then we have a propagator. Alpha theta minus phi eta alpha theta over Q. Is it Q1? Yeah, that's going to be that same Q1 squared. And then one more vertex, a U bar of Q prime minus IE. I lost the minus IE here. Gamma theta. So I think, now I could have slipped up at some point or other here. I'm a little uncertain on the ordering of these fermion propagators, whether I've got those ordered right. But I don't exactly see how else they could go. Yeah, you know, maybe there's some symmetrization trick or something that needs to be done to get that ordering right. But this is the kind of thing you would write down. You just work through the diagram and write all the terms. And then, you know, at each vertex you get an integral over the momenta, and the momenta are all determined at each vertex by conservation of momentum, but you'll have one extra integral over Q2 will be the divergent integral. Is this answering your question? So about now you start writing computer code to figure out, you know, what this really does. There are a lot of diagrams of this order.
Q2. Q2?
Yeah, so Q2 is going to be the free momentum. So, there's a Q2 undetermined in this loop. So, you know, if we draw that loop more carefully. So, we've got Q1 coming in and Q1 going out. Right? And then we have, we think of this as the electron over here going around, and B minus over there coming back. We have Q2 here, and over here we have an amount Q1 minus Q2. Well, let's see. That's the way I want it. Let me write it the other way. Let's say. Now I'm wondering about what sign I want to put on this. Okay, if this carries off a momentum, Q1 plus Q2, then this could be bringing in a momentum Q2. It depends on which way I think of that momentum is going. So if the positron is carrying Q2 this direction, then here I should have Q2 coming out, Q1 plus Q2 coming in, and another T1 going out that way. So maybe we need to change the signs on these. But that's the basic idea. Then, all right, when we're looking at this kind of diagram, it looks like this kind of vertex, where we have a minus I, E, gamma, alpha, minus I, E, gamma, U. So to write that vertex, I want to write it just like I wrote this one, where I've got a U coming in, that's the U2 of T1 plus T2 now. But this is a little different than what I was writing before. But so we have U2, so T1 plus T2. And then we have minus I, E, gamma, alpha. And then we have V bar going out this way. That's like this one coming back here. Is a V bar of U2. So maybe that's the right way to write that vertex. Yeah, I haven't done enough blue things to have my Feynman rules down. Incidentally, Maggiore is very brief about his Feynman rules. If you go to something like it's an Zuber or most quantum field theory books, we'll have an appendix with all the Feynman rules written out, and you get a lot more detail, and you get careful sign conventions, and exactly how you handle the propagators and such. So this is all determined by the Feynman rules. There's not ambiguity here, so that I sound ambiguous because I haven't been clue what I'm doing. I'd have to go back and think about the rules. But this is the kind of thing.
Okay, good. Yeah. I've got a question. Oh, go ahead, Jeff.
Good question.
Go ahead, Joe.
Hold that thought. Yeah.
Okay, a little bit off track, unfortunately, but if you have this additional loop, then I understand that there's a 1 over alpha squared chance of that, or no, it goes like
alpha,
1 over
alpha is
squared.
1 over...
times the 137 and the
37, yeah.
So it's that squared less likely to happen.
Yes, that's right. So
where does alpha come out?
Each time you have one of these vertices, you're bringing in a factor of e, and when you square the matrix element, then you get squared.
Okay.
So you get an e squared, which is 4 pi squared e squared is alpha, or e squared over 4 pi squared is a fine chart.
Oh, it's just that.
Yeah. So we're working in units where e squared is alpha.
So then on the renormalization, all of those are part of what you're normalizing, right? All of those probabilities, or?
Now, the renormalization is handling an integral over these propagators. You're integrating Q2 over all Q2, and that's going to diverge. You've got a pole, you offset by an I epsilon, and you do renormalization tricks to handle this. But it's not going to affect the overall power of E squared. Now, renormalization does insist that some of the E squareds end up the calculation being fine structure time, being the number we know E to be. And that entails assuming that the bare electron charge is some cutoff dependent thing that just absorbs the right stuff in the limit and becomes the value we know. Right? So at the end of the calculation, that E squared is going to be the fine structure constant, 1 over 137. And for each vertex, then, once you square it, there will be one factor of the fine structure constant in that final cross section. And so those a term within vertices will be suppressed by alpha to the n. Right, so in this case, we've added two vertices.
That's right.
That suppresses this diagram relative to the first, by a factor alpha squared, because we've introduced two more vertices. And 1 over 137 squared, okay, that's a very small number, so you'll see it in the decimal place or something.
It comes out more easily than I thought it might.
Yeah. That element of the perturbation theory, it works very nicely in QED. Weak interaction, strong interaction, not so convergent, but because the coupling constant is the order of one there, and so that now it's time to get out of the computer and do lattice QCD and really sum over paths. But in QED you have a very successful perturbation theory, but it won't show its asymptotic character until you're gazillions of terms out. Won't be relevant. You get extremely good results from. Do you remember how many terms you have to go before QED?
400
terms.
Yeah.
So not a problem. Alpha to 400. Who's going to write a, Feynman diagram with 400 verses?
It'll take you longer than your lifetime, right? Do it by hand.
Yeah, the number of diagrams seems to be going up like end to the end to the end to the end or something, didn't we? At order 400, there are a lot of Feynman diagrams, and what we need is some entirely other calculational method if you really want to be doing things like that. Which maybe
exists. I have another question.
Yes.
Another renormalization question.
Uh-huh.
When we were doing the scalar field, and it's a little hazy, but when we were doing the scalar field, it was like we could write it. It seemed like he was writing a diagram like this, say, as, okay, that S-channel diagram plus that S-channel diagram plus another one with two loops plus another one with three loops, and then you can factor out that diagram in the front and then add all that other stuff with all the extra loops together.
Can you do that
in QED? Because before it was a scalar field theory, and I was wondering if there's a difference, or if...
Now, if you can... suppose we wanted a photon loop on an external line. That... only has an effect on this, I was going to say the propagator, but you don't even write these legs, you don't write a propagator for these legs, you've already truncated the diagram, so that doesn't play a role, but such a thing, dressing, say an internal line like this, would the effect of that would be something that you could just take into the thumb and write the renormalized propagator for the whole thing.
So that's the situation where we're saying, okay, the incoming electron is on the mass shell. We've already kind of assumed that we've already put all the renormalization into its charge and its mass.
Yeah. And be
done with it. Okay.
Yeah.
So, but it's these internal ones that we have to now calculate separately.
I think here if we had an extra photon line, something like this, that leads to another loop which requires renormalization, but if taken into account by renormalizing this propagator, you put in the final mass here, and you've already taken care of that kind of loop.
Okay.
So that's just a place where it crops up, and then that will make a difference. You don't have to do that.
Okay.
We're supposed to be negative IE, right, in this gamma?
Did I leave off of it?
Gamma,
okay.
I think also in a couple terms over... Q1, it should be Q1 minus Q2 in the squared on the bottom, in the denominator. On the top you have the difference, and on the bottom you have the sum.
I see. Which did we decide it is? Yeah, which of these stories did you guys like best? the Q1 plus Q2 and the Q2 going backwards, or...
Does it matter? Because can't you just Oh, because you can make it negative.
Well, yeah, you've got to integrate overall Q2.
Squared.
Anyway, so it may not matter, but we should just be consistent about
okay.
it. So, pretend we're saying minus here. That's one of the dimensions that I'm not certain about.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. But, these things are fine. You know, if you guys would like to do more QED, we could work through some renormalization and, do some more calculations. We could do Mueller scattering and, analyze Bremsstrahlung. And, there are a bunch of problems that are, a manageable order. You can do it second order, but, are fundamental processes that come up all the time in kind of spirit physics stuff, it's relevant stuff. I was thinking of moving on at this point. I mean, you guys are going to be doing the constant scattering, and any questions you want to bring to class and have us sort of ponder through, that's fine, we'll do that. I was thinking of going on to the electroweak theory from here. And, I see a lot of head nodding, so let's go ahead and do that. But, QED, it's a lot of fun. Matt Gary does not spend a lot of time on it. But it's well understood, and, there are, there's a bit more technique in what we've covered. But it's basically, handling those loops. Things like that, and where you put in the renormalization. Another thing that is a technique in QED that we haven't mentioned are form factors. You can approximate a complicated charge system by putting in some unknown functions, basically called form factors. So. If you're scattering, say you're scattering an electron off a proton. Well, a proton is not a point particle like an electron. A proton is a very complicated bound state of three charged particles and the associated gluons. Half the mass of the proton is due to those gluons, at least, maybe considerably more. So. You're dealing with a fairly complicated bound state when you scatter a simple particle like an electron off that proton. And to handle the distribution of charges, you put in what are called form factors. Matt Gary actually has that in his appendix. I think he has a calculation of some form factors. And you can read that. I haven't, so I'm not going to try to say anything more about it, but it's one more technique that we haven't introduced to apply QED in some situations. So, electroweak. There's some history to electroweak. It's what's called a four-Fermi interaction. Somebody always does this. I guess it's a good introduction. You can see some of the stuff that doesn't work. The early experiments that dealt with weak interactions. Well, the simplest case is something like neutron decay. You have a neutron, and what you see coming out is a proton and an electron. And, you've got a black box here. You don't know what goes on in there. You don't have quite enough tools yet to study it. And there, the immediate problem that arose when people saw this kind of interaction was what? Who knows?
Momentum conservation.
Exactly. Yeah. Yes. This room. Sorry. It did not conserve momentum. Right. There was some energy and momentum missing in the final state, and that led people. Well, Jeremy named it. To posit another particle coming out of here. The neutrino, Italian for little neutral one.
Little neutron.
Neutrino.
What's that? He wanted to name it neutron, but it was taken.
Did he want to name it neutron?
I don't think that Chadwick had come up with the neutron, but you know, a year or two before.
Well, certainly would have known about it. So anyway, the neutrino, and in order to conserve lepton number, it's taken to be an anti-neutrino, and then to conserve family, it turns out that this has to be an electron neutrino, not a muon neutrino or a tau neutrino, which showed up later. But this is now the interaction that you're talking about. And it can happen in any of various forms. You can collide a positron with a neutron and get a proton out, and somewhere there's going to be an anti-neutrino coming out. Again, you don't know what goes on there. The first attempt to describe it was to write what's called the four Fermi interaction. I'll say right away that it's wrong, but what you do is you add to the action. Let's take an action that's got a spinner field. And then we're going to add to it pi bar of psi squared. And, you know, that's enough to allow you to account for this sort of thing in principle. We put that inner product is the norm. There's some coupling constant G associated with it. And that permits diagrams where you have four fermions coming together. You know, two in, two out. You could have one in and three out. You could have three in and one out if you could get them to collide. And you can have any of them be any of them. So in principle, you could have a neutrino come together with proton, and let's see, what would they produce? You better have some kind of what would this be? No, got the wrong lepton number. Let's make it an antiproton coming in and hitting a neutrino. Then that'll have minus one charge, so we conserve charge with an electron and a neutrino in the neutron in the final state. So, something like that could happen.
So does this still keep the derivative covariant then, or that?
Covariant with this derivative you're worried about?
Well, with that term, we usually add a term, right, to make the derivative covariant, right?
Oh, that's not what we're doing here.
Okay.
Right, this is not a gauge theory.
Okay.
The correct answer is a gauge theory. Right,
okay.
And we introduced the gauge particles, the W plus or minus and the C. So that's the answer we're leaning towards here. This happened first. This is just a historical curiosity, I suppose. Although he does go through and calculate some stuff with it, so I'm wondering if there are some important lessons to be learned by actually analyzing this diagram. He observes that you can do this with a scalar intermediary. So if you had two fermions exchanging a scalar, so you had, say, your proton and your neutron, and you exchange, what would have to be true of the scalar field in order for this diagram to work? What kind of scalar would it have to be?
Charged
scalar, which means it would be a complex scalar field. So only complex scalars have electric charge. But then you'd be okay. And you'd have a propagator that goes like 1 over, or say, minus I over T squared minus M squared, where M is the mass of the scalar field. And if T squared is much less than M squared, so you've kind of got a low energy scatter, this goes to I over M, and ends up looking like the four fermi interaction, if you had a coupling constant. So if you had a coupling constant little g here, then the propagator would have a g, and this would be like a big g, you know, four fermi interaction like this. So you can get a four fermi interaction as a limit of the scalar field exchange. Let's see. Now he's going to go off and talk about charge. I think it's horribly divergent. There was some problem with this, and I don't remember what it is. I'll have to read up on that. But what happens instead is what you know is the electroweak. Or actually, before electroweak, this is a strength of the whole thing. I wonder if we want to do electroweak or if we want to do just the weak interaction first. Looks like he's going strength of the whole thing.
Before you go on, can you say something about that G term? And do we need to know what's going on there? Did you say that's an inner product or a product?
Pi bar phi is the inner product of a pair of spinners. So that's some complex number. There's some real number, actually. And you square that. And this is just a constant.
Okay.
That's
a scalar.
No. This is not with a scalar. This theory would be something like a spinner ID flash minus M phi, and then you would have a scalar coupling to psi bar, scalar, what should we call it? distance that those colors fly. So it would have some scalar field coupling to psi bar psi. Now, for it to carry charge, how do we get that to carry charge? You know, we'd probably have to write something like the real part of
it.
You know, we'd probably have to add the complex conjugate to it. If you would write anything like this. Okay, so two ways we could think about this. We could do this with a real scalar field. If we do it with a real scalar field, then we don't get this interaction, right, which actually is possible. So this model would not work to predict that. So with a real scalar field, you would write something like phi bar I u phi h minus phi. And then you'd have some massive scalar field. So you'd have a d mu phi term, probably a f d mu phi plus or minus m. So here's the mass for the scalar field. So we have some massive scalar field. And then we have a coupling like this with some coupling constant g. So little g is a constant. And that action would allow not this, but you could have let's see, that's kind of tricky. You know, this would be maybe the proton producing an anti-electron with scalar fields carrying off other properties and producing a neutron over here requiring an anti-neutrino coming in there. So you preserve lepton numbers there.
Charge.
Baryon number there, charge, so that looks like it conserves everything. And there, now these vertices also conserve charge, so you can do that much with a real scalar field. And he doesn't address it, and he doesn't write this, but if you wanted that scalar field to actually account for neutron decay, for example, let's see, well, you could flip this. Yeah, flip the top, or, you know, read it top to bottom, and that could be neutron decay, but you then need that particle coming in. Let's see, can we do neutron decay this way? So the neutron would emit a phi particle. We have to conserve charge, so the neutrino would have to come out over here, the anti-neutrino there, and then this would decay into an E minus E P plus pair. So there we get everything. We've preserved lepton number. Let's see. Yeah, so this would have to carry some lepton number.
Two?
Oh, no. Well, that's an N. So we have zero. We have zero in the final state, so maybe. That virtual lepton number, I don't know. So you can get neutron decay. So you can get a bunch of the interactions. They just occur in a funny order. You don't have continuity of the baryon line unless that phi, well, the phi is some massive scalar field. So, you know, presumably that makes sense. And then it's emitting the leptons. You could think of it that way, and it's not such a bizarre thing to contemplate. So you can ask whether you can account for what you see this way. But of course, we know what the answer is. The answer is that we have other intermediates, and we can treat it as a gauge theory. Let's just treat it as a gauge theory today. Get the skipping action. We need to get around to writing down an action. He starts doing it with current. You know, there's another thing that happens. That's mostly all he talks about. Weak interactions violate parity. If you look at a weak interaction in the mirror, you don't the mirrored reaction does not occur with the same probabilities as the original reaction. And so there's something in the weak interaction that violates handedness. It treats the right-handed and the left-handed of the spinner field differently. And you can project out those fields. It turns out when you start analyzing the asymmetry due to parity violation that it's actually maximally parity violating. It's like the interaction only occurs with the left-handed electron, not the right-handed electron. Now, the handedness comes because there is a projection operator. There's a pair of projection operators, one plus or minus gamma 5. Notice that if I square this, one plus or minus gamma 5, one plus or minus gamma 5, actually I want the operator is going to be a half of that. So when I square it, I get a quarter. So multiplying this out, I have a quarter, I get a 1, plus or minus gamma 5, plus or minus gamma 5, plus gamma 5 squared. Gamma 5 squared is the 1. So I get 1 plus 1 is 2, so I'm going to have a half left over, and I get 2 gamma 5, so we're back to where we started. 1 plus or minus gamma 5. But I think squares itself, that's called idempotent. With an M. These operators are idempotent, that's equivalent to their being projection operators. Okay, how do we see that? You know, suppose some operator squares to itself. Then if I look at t squared minus t, that's 0. Gamma 5 dagger is gamma 5, so this thing's Hermitian. So it has real eigenvalues. Okay, I'm trying to say that, you know, you can write this as t minus 1 equals 0. And that says that the determinant of t is going to be either 1 or 0. Well, if the determinant is 1, you know, t's just the identity. So the identity satisfies this. But you're going to expect t in general to have 0 eigenvalues. Let's see. You know, it might be a fun exercise. We'll just mention it. Show that the eigenvalues of t are all zero or one. So what you get is some matrix of the form that's got one zeros on the diagonal. Like this. That's a projection operator. Right? A one is going to preserve that component of the vector it acts on. A zero is going to knock out that component. So you're projecting to just those few components where you've got a one. So for example, one and zero take A, B to A, zero, to just knock out the B component. That's the kind of thing that you're doing. And notice that this matrix squares to itself. Any matrix of this form squares to itself. Well, in fact, any matrix that squares to itself can be put in that form. So you'd be doing this exercise proving the converse of that thing. Anything of this form is isomorphic. Okay, so we have these. We showed before that one plus or minus gamma 5 acting on a spinner gives a left or right-handed spinner. Or right or left-handed. The plus, I think, gives the right-handed. The minus gives the left-handed. I'm pretty sure that's the way it worked out. Let's see, how did we see that? We actually acted with a rotation on this. We picked the basis for the gamma matrices. And if you go back to the notes online, I'm sure you'll see where we talked about this, where we were doing spinners. We get a rotation, and depending on whether you had a plus or a minus here, the rotation acted very simply. It either rotated it or ignored it. Right? There were the two different independent rotations you could do. And the one that's right-handed, the one that's left-handed, the spin axis. Let's see, for a massless fermion, it's whether the spin axis is aligned or anti-aligned with the direction of propagation of the field. In any case, it's that sort of thing. I don't know. Do we want to dig in and review that? Do you need to see that again? The electroweak interaction involves the left-handed fermion. So what we want to do is write an action built out of this sort of fermion only, just the one minus gamma 5 projection of the spinners. Now that turns out to be easy because if I take, let's call this phi left. If I take phi left dagger, what happens? There's a half, I get a phi dagger, and then gamma 5 is Hermitian, so I just get the 1 minus gamma 5 here. On the other hand, remember that gamma 5 anti-commutes with all of the gamma mu's. So if I interchange a position with any of the gamma matrices, I get a sign. So if I write an action, phi bar, IV slash, let's just write a drag action here and see what happens. Suppose I put a left-handed spinner right there. Then let's take a look at what happens as I move that projection through. Phi bar I d slash minus m phi l is equal to phi bar I d slash minus m 1/2 1 minus gamma 5 phi. And now I'd like to move that through, but there's a set of gamma matrices sitting here. and each of those can be commuted to that gamma 5. So what I'm going to get is 5r, this is going to turn into 1 half 1 plus gamma 5 when I commute it past the d slash. The m is going to, the m is not going to care. Well, that's sort of weird.
Minus.
Okay. I was going to say the gamma 0 is going to fix this, but it's not going to fix the one by the m. So remember that 5r has, again, 0 here. And to bring this past the gamma 0 is going to correct that sign change. So we've got half 1 plus gamma 5 d slash. And then we've got this one. So the math term we're going to have to worry about a little bit.
This is why you want neutrinos to be massless.
Maybe.
It comes in somewhere, right?
Maybe, yeah. Yeah. Then how do you fix it? You know? They're not, right?
Well, Kevin thinks so.
What's that?
Kevin and Crane think so. These are massless too.
Oh.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Okay, so, that's right. All right, let's make all our neutrinos massless. Let's see. All right, well, clearly it works with the other piece here. This is going to be a half 1 minus gamma 5 gamma 0 d slash psi. And then we have the math term. What is the math term? We minus 5r phi l. Well, we'll look at that in a minute. But here, this turns into a left-handed psi dagger, and times the gamma 0 d slash psi. In fact, since it squares to itself, I could have written this as that operator squared and left one behind. So I could just as well, you know, leave the L on that one too. So putting in one projection matrix is enough to guarantee that both of the spinners in that expression are left-handed. That wouldn't work with the mass term. You know, the mass term, the other one needs to be right-handed. So maybe that's why neutrinos are massless. Let's go with Jeff on this one. Because he's writing it for the maybe this is why we need the Higgs. Where's the, now the Higgs is for the gauge boson. He doesn't talk about this enough. I should dig up another reference on this stuff. And of course, there's not more detail. So anyway, back to the main points here. Violation of parity requires that somewhere in our formulation we work with left-handed fermions. So we're going to put in these projection operators when we put in the spinners. There's some issue with the math. We'll sort that out. The Wright theory turns out to be not the four-Fermi interaction or the massive scalar. It turns out to be a gauge theory of U1 cross SU2. It's a direct product group. And it gives us the electroweak theory. It's the theory of both the electromagnetic and the weak interaction. And understand from the beginning, I said this before, that the U1 cross SU2, that U1 is not the U1 of electromagnetism. That's part of a compound gauge group that actually non-trivially couples these different fields. So we'll be writing a theory that involves an interaction between pairs of spinners and some gauge bosons. The coupling will be totally determined by the gauge theory. Before it was written down, the gauge theory was called minimal coupling, where you put a vector particle in with the covariant derivative. So instead of a partial d flash, that becomes a covariant d flash, and the connection is made up of the gauge particles. And we'll see how all that happens. We'll run through all of that. So the thing we want to write down is, let's do that. Let's see how much time you have. You have to write down an action for electroweak. Issues about math.
How did you get the last term over here?
With the
minus M.
That. All right, that one. I just carried it along. It was there. Here's the M. And the projection would go right through it. The problem is, if I push it through all the way, I'm going to end up with a psi right over here. Right? Because as soon as it passes the gamma zero, there's a gamma zero in this psi bar. So if I take the projection off this psi and put it on that one, it's going to become a right projection, not a left projection. Which is sort of weird. Yeah, you were wondering where it came from. It's this term carried on through. So the left is the same as that projection operator.
Okay.
So this operator acting on psi is psi left. Is that what you were meant?
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Right. So we suppose we have a non-interacting theory described by an action, let's just say Coyote slash Schweinen stem psi. L. So we know it's silent parity, so let it act on left-handed spinners. We'll sort out the math like that. And what we want to do is take the partial derivative to a covariant derivative. And the covariant derivative will be a partial, I'm going to want to work out the sign convention. Let me write minus for now. But what we're going to want is some element of... We want a Lie algebra value of one form. All right, well, one form is just a covariant vector. So what we need is some... what should I call it here? You can call it... Maybe summed on a generator, a vector. Okay, so we're summing B over all the generators of the group. Well, there are four generators of the group, right? Where G is a generator of U1 cross SU2. Right, so SU2 has three generators, U1 just there. So we get four generators. it's easy enough to write down the algebra of these things. Let's say we've got a G. Oh, let's see, what do we want to call these things? Let's say G4 is the phase. And that commutes with the other three, commutes with itself, then the GI and GJ are going to have an FU2 commutation. If we use Pauli matrices, it would be 2IS1IJK GK. You can rescale it to change the QI if you like, but it's your basic FU2 commutation relation. So that's what the G's do. Now, the G's are in a linear representation. That is, they're some kind of matrices, and they know how to act on our spinners. So, let's see. Now, what is it they do? What is it they do? The simplest kinds of things that they can act on are going to be pairs, where chi beta is just some two component thing, and it'll mix up those pairs. This is characteristic of the electroweak interaction. We'll be dealing with pairs of fields, and it's for precisely this reason that when people talk about the standard model, they write the leptons with their associated neutrinos as doublets. The tau and the tau neutrino. Each of these is one of these pairs that the FU2 knows about. Right? So alpha and beta here run from 1 to 2. So the FU2 is going to be our normal Pauli matrices, basically, and it's going to mix up the electron field with the neutrino field. Similarly, quarks, up and down, charms, strange, top, bottom. Right? Those are all FU2 doublets. So these vectors are, these are things like chi beta, where beta equals 1 to 2. Those are the kinds of things that we'll be acting on. So, what's going to happen is we'll have pairs from alpha equal 1 to 2 of these. We replace a covariant derivative here, where that derivative knows how to mix those pairs of components. So, what you have here will be, an electron neutrino over here. You can have an up and down quark. And they could exchange the particle A corresponding to the gauge field of this group. Okay, we're probably running short of time, so let's leave it there. But we'll do this in increasing detail, and it seems clear that we're going to need a little bit different set of notes to do it. I have too many. Surely some of these don't work.